Hi, this is Pete Link, and you're back at the Thursday podcast of churchandgospel.com, where we help area Bible teachers begin to wrestle with the Explore the Bible lessons that are upcoming. Joshua 13 through 22 is our topic today. We're in the midst of studying the book of Joshua, and I hope that your Christmas season was exciting. I hope that the pace of teaching has actually helped you enjoy Christmas more. I mean, one of the great things about being a Bible teacher is that you get to encounter God week after week in the text. You get the burden of leading people. Yes, it's tiring, it's exhausting, but what joy it is to have the privilege to stand before people and to attempt to rightly say, and it is an attempt, thus says the Lord. What a great joy. We hope that we're helping you in that process. We want to remind you that we have the Epic Bible Teacher Training Series that comes up once a quarter. The next one will be in February. We'll tell you more about that as we draw closer. We'll be dealing in that quarter, getting ready in March, April, and May, with the second half of the book of Matthew. But today we're in Joshua, and so we want to turn that attention now to that now. Now, in the book of Joshua, we are dealing with Israel going into the land, and it's part of a larger story of Israel not only going into the land in Joshua, but their time in the land in Judges, Samuel, Kings, and eventually at the end of Kings of being thrown out of the land. So across this great story, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, we have an invitation to think about Israel's time in the land. Was it good? Was it bad? Well, on balance, it's about the same thing that you saw in the Torah, which is every time something good happened, there's a bunch of bad with it too. Kind of like the life that you and I are tempted to lead here in this world. And think about the things we've already seen in Joshua as you get ready to teach chapter 13 through 22. A lot of things to cover, but listen, you have seen God say, I will be with you as I was with Moses. And we see Joshua is to meditate upon the scriptures in order to encounter God and to have guidance from God. And then, of course, we see troubles with that as we go through. When the conquest happened, we saw Jericho was destroyed. And when Jericho was destroyed, we saw that in the midst of judgment, there was salvation, there was life, because a woman, Rahab, who was a Gentile, who was marked for death, found life by fearing God and having faith in God, and she was made a part of God's people. On the other hand, we saw Achan, and what happened with Achan? Achan was a part of God's people, a part of his conquering army, and yet he coveted, and he did not fear God, and he sinned greatly, and he took from the devoted things. And as Rahab brought life to herself and to others, Achan brought death to himself and to others. And that indeed, the story reminds, those two stories back to back remind us of this, that the people of God are defined by how they respond to the word of God. It was Rahab's response. It was Achan's response that defined who they were in relationship to God's people. So this is the central problem. Why is God judging the Canaanites? He's judging them because of the great sin. And this judgment, I've argued in the past few podcasts, is concerned with the upcoming judgment for the whole creation, the death of the creation, and the day of the Lord. So what Moses and the prophets are longing for is a time when God will be on earth. Well, the problem is every time God and man come together, somebody dies. And so the book of Joshua is showing us what happens when God's presence, remember the Ark of the Covenant is there? When God's presence comes in to encounter not only the Canaanites, but these Israelites. Indeed, what do we find out? The Israelites are just as uncircumcised of heart as the Canaanites. They are indeed Canaanites by a different name in many ways. But that doesn't mean Joshua is doing the wrong thing. In fact, Joshua is doing the right thing. And he's a good leader. He's a faithful leader. But the one part of the promised land he will not be able to conquer when all said and done is the human heart. And indeed, only the Messiah, the Joshua, Jesus, will be able to change hearts in that way. So what happened as they went into the land, we saw the conquest of Jericho as a preview of the conquest of the whole creation. We saw because of Achan's sin that the conquest of Ai was convoluted. And then we saw finally the Gibeonites deceiving Joshua and Israel, and they became a part of God's people. But what happened after that? Well, the other nations then attacked Gibeon for becoming a part of Israel. And just as Abraham rescued Lot in Genesis 14 from the Battle of All the Nations, Joshua and Israel rescue the Gibeonites. And in so doing, God gets glory. And we begin to see in chapter the last half of chapter 10, chapter 11, and chapter 12, all the nations and all the kings and kingdoms that are conquered. In a very real way, Joshua is becoming a king of kings. So finally we get to the next few chapters, and they're not exciting reading. I mean, this is the part of Joshua where most people really struggle in their quiet times. And there's parts of the Bible that are like that. There's law codes, genealogies, and you know, right now when we see the dividing of the land up, the land of Canaan, it's not necessarily the most exciting reading, but it is meaningful reading. So the question that I left you with last week was this, or last time, I guess it was 2 weeks ago, was, is the conquest successful or not successful? Is Joshua proving successful? Now, in the end, we're going to see that the conquest does not conquer the land completely, and we begin to understand why that is, not only in Joshua, but also in the book of Judges. It's a major topic of discussion. But we see that the land of Canaan will be divided amongst the tribes, and we begin to see some trouble along the way. The land is described and divided up by the 12 tribes, the 12 sons. Now, remember, the tribes of Israel are the 12 sons of Jacob, with some exceptions. Levi will have no land. We'll see a special allotment for Levi coming up. Why? Because Levi's inheritance is God. That's where the priest will come from the family of Aaron, but also those who take care of the tabernacle. They will be from the tribe of Levi. So that should leave us with 11. But no, because the tribe of Joseph is divided between his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who are his two older sons, who are treated like their uncles. They are tribes, and they will be very important tribes throughout the scriptures. So you, as you go through this and you read these names, you say, I've heard these names in Genesis. You have. So that the 12 sons of Jacob have become the 12 tribes of Israel. There's a direct correlation there. And along the way, we're going to see the beginnings of trouble. Look at chapter 13, verse 20. But the sons of Israel did not dispossess, that means they did not move off the land, the Geshurites or the Maacathites, for Geshur and Maacath live among Israel until this day. So you see hints already that things are not exactly as they should be. But nonetheless, you see a plan for the inheritance of the land being laid out. And don't forget along the way that we have 2.5 tribes, that their land is on the other side of the river, and they've left their family and their cattle back there. And we're going to see before too long they get to head back that way. So in chapter 14, where we then see in the midst of this inheritance, we see somebody who was faithful all the way back to Numbers 13 and 14. Joshua and Caleb were the two spies in Numbers 13 and 14 who said, let's go in. The other 10 spies said no. Israel said no. And God put that generation to die in the wilderness. But Joshua and Caleb were faithful, and Joshua and Caleb are here entering the land. And Caleb receives his possession of the land in chapter 14. And then you see the actual division of the land tribe by tribe. Now, the order of the tribes is not incidental or accidental. It is intentional, and it's a reminder of some larger themes out of the Torah. We know that the oldest sons were Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, but we know from Genesis 49 that the Messiah and the leader of Israel will not come from Reuben because he lay down with one of his father's wives, or Simeon and Levi because they destroyed the men of Shechem deceitfully, but it'll come to Judah. The Messiah will be from the tribe of Judah. He will look like Joseph, but he will be from the tribe of Judah. And indeed, that this emphasis upon Judah in chapter 15, Judah goes first, not only because Caleb's from there, but also because this is the tribe that the leaders will come out of. So what was the next most important person in Genesis? Joseph, right? The son of Judah and Joseph. And so in chapter 16 and 17, you focus on Joseph's two sons and their inheritance, Ephraim and Manasseh. Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, finally, you move from those two significant tribes, Judah, Joseph. Remember, Joseph is Ephraim and Manasseh. And then you move into the other tribes and their getting of land. And is it important that we start with Benjamin and we go on to Simeon? And chapter 19, Simeon and Zebulun and Issachar and Asher and Naphtali and Dan. And these are where their land is to be divided. And these are the particular inheritances that you see for each of the tribe. Now, when you get to chapter 20, you get to a very, very significant point. In chapter 20, we're reminded that Moses said, when you go into the land, we need to have a place where we can minimize bloodshed on the land, minimize Israel's guilt before God. Because when we're guilty before God, it means death and judgment for us. So he established these places called cities of refuge. Now, what they were in the Torah is they were places that were promised that, that would be in the land where if somebody were accidentally killed, what you and I would probably call manslaughter, that the person who had accidentally killed somebody else could run there and not be killed for the accident. Now, this not only preserved the life of the one who committed the accident, and it also preserved the life of those who would want to seek vengeance. Because if it was just an accident and they killed the man who had accidentally killed their relative, they would be bringing judgment upon themselves. So to minimize how much blood would be shed on the ground, how much death there would be, and therefore how much judgment there would be, to minimize that, these cities of refuge were a place where somebody could run to. And that's what chapter 20 is dealing with. And it's very important that you understand that in many ways, all the laws that you see in the Torah are designed kind of like a city of refuge. The law codes do not eliminate the problem of sin, but they minimize the consequences of it in many ways. The law codes have two major purposes. One is to show us the way things should be, and there are some law codes you can think of that way. But others are law codes that reach to where humanity is and point him back to the way he should be, but it accepts the reality of life in this world, and the cities of refuge reflect that. There's a clear understanding from Moses that the conquest under Joshua will in the long run fail, and that Israel's time in the land will not be perfect, but we want it to be as long as possible. We want them to enjoy as much of the land as possible. So these cities of refuge become a way to lengthen Israel's time on the land by minimizing the sin, minimizing the bloodshed. So that takes you to chapter 21. And in chapter 21, lo and behold, you see that you have the Levites will have land spread out all through the promised land. Now, this is to me a very amazing concept. Because what I said earlier is that when you go through the tribes, I said that Levi's inheritance is the Lord himself. There's not a particular tract of land that it says this is Levi's land. Instead, the whole promised land will be filled with Levites. Now, why is that? Because Levites and priests are going to deal with two things. One is sacrifices, which everybody knows about at the tabernacle, later at the temple. But the more important one, according to Moses, at the end of the Torah, is the teaching of the Torah. The teaching of the Bible. So it's quite fitting to me that you have 48 cities set aside for the Levites, so that each of the 12 tribes, they have an area where Levites will be there, so that if, say, the tabernacle will go there, there's Levites there for that. But also there are Levites there to do what? To teach the Torah. It's as if not only a singular place is to be where God is supposed to be, but the whole land is to be a place where God is to be present and to preserve his people and to remind them of what he said and to keep them alive. And so you have 48 cities that are set aside for the Levites. This is not just an accommodation for their life in the land. It's an accommodation by God to make sure that the teaching of the Torah is to be done. And of course, what's going to happen is you read the rest of Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, you're going to find out that they did a terrible job. And in fact, this is one of the points towards the end of the book of Judges. They did a terrible job at passing on the Torah. So it's not surprising to me that that we see God emphasizing this, but never presenting the tabernacle and the Levites and the priesthood under Aaron as a solution to the problem. Just a way to minimize the sin until the solution comes, that is the Messiah Jesus. Now, finally, you get to chapter 22, which is the last thing we'll focus on, and we see that Reuben, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh, who have land on the other side of the Jordan, east of the Jordan, are told by Joshua, you've been faithful, you've helped your brothers claim their land. Now, we're going to find they haven't conquered everything, but despite that, Joshua says, you've reached the time where you can go back home, and Joshua sends them back home. And when he sends them back home, the Israelites look up and they see Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh building an altar. Uh-oh. Now, what you should remember is that the only altar to God that they're supposed to be is at the tabernacle. The tabernacle is the place where sacrifices are to be made to God. And so, when the rest of Israel sees Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh making their own altar, the fear is, oh no, our brothers have become like the Canaanites. They're going to have to be placed under the ban like Canaanites. And we are ready in Joshua 22 for a civil war between God's people, between Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh, and the rest of the tribes. Fortunately, as we get ready for this war, we discover that Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh are not there to build an altar for sacrifice. They describe it as a memorial altar, just like the memorial stones when they came into the Promised Land. And they said that this altar is to remind your sons that our sons are part of God's people. It's in this way that the rest of Israel says, well, that's great, because now we don't have to kill each other. And indeed, we see that the altar was just meant to remind their fellow brothers that indeed they were brothers. Now, that echoes some other things from the Torah, Jacob's relationship with Laban in particular. But beyond that, we see that indeed the scope of God's blessing of Israel is indeed much larger than just that land of Canaan itself, and that the people are to be reminded that God is a God who will keep all of his promises, and the way that he will do that in the end is through his people, and his people will indeed, hopefully, and eventually, in the very end, in the after the day of the Lord, and the new heavens and new earth, there will be a people of God who will actually love each other rightly and will be brothers and sisters under the banner of the Messiah, and there will be perfect peace forever and ever. But in Joshua 22, civil war averted, we're back to the point of not being in a world of perfect peace. And what that does is that sets us up for next week's podcast, which is looking at Joshua chapters 23 and 24. And in Joshua 23 and 24, next week, we'll see that Joshua describes in a painstaking way why Israel has not completely eliminated the Canaanites and why we must wait for God's real Joshua, that is Jesus, to come and bring us the deliverance that we need. So thank you so much for joining us. I hope this is helping you as you begin to teach the Bible or continue to teach the Bible. Join us week by week on Thursdays as we try to set up Bible teachers, and we thank you for your ministry. Thank you for being a part of us here at churchandgospel.com.